Good morning, everyone. When I got here today, I was greeted by Dan and Steve. Thank you, Dan. You know me too well. Shaking black stuff everywhere from the copier, and I was reminded again. I do appreciate all the things that everybody does right now at the chapel, things that we need but aren't always done. But I do want to thank every one of you for all the work that you've been doing just to chip in and help us continue in the state that we're in. So thanks again. Thanks again for Corey for driving me. I did get good news on Thursday. I went to my surgeon, and Tuesday will be a month from the accident, but he doesn't count that because he counts the day that I had surgery. So I'll be back to full force May 22nd. That's the day I keep looking forward. So wow, so there it comes. So anyways, I walked into the surgeon, and I think the cast lady came, took my cast off, and so the first thing I wanted to do was go to the bathroom and wash my arms and hands because I've been waiting to do that for a long time. So I gingerly walked down to the hall to do that. In the meantime, the surgeon, who is ridiculously young, Twyla asked him how old he is. He's 35. I was floored, but shows how old I am. But anyways, he gave me a rough time when I came back. He said, "Where were you? I was on time today. How rare is that?" Which is pretty rare. But and then he said, "Those are my arms and hands that you have now, and please don't do anything with them. And so you can't wash them or do anything until you get my permission." Okay. But anyways, he said, "Hey, good news." I looked at the x-rays, and he said, "I'm going to negotiate with you on the right arm." He said, "The left arm, I'm totally okay with giving you a removable splint, but the left arm probably should have a cast for 2 more weeks. And he said, "Here's the deal." He said, "Long run, it's not going to make a difference. The only difference a cast would have for 2 more weeks, it would mean less pain for you. But if you're willing to endure the pain for 2 weeks, I will give you a splint on your right arm as well." So I asked Twyla what she thought. Of course, she refused to answer. So I was just thrilled that he was willing to negotiate. And of course, I chose the pain over the 2 more weeks of restriction. So it is beautiful to have my hands back, and I get to drive again. So that's also really nice. So get to drive at this point. By the way, Pennsylvania, they do not have any laws about driving with broken arms, I discovered. So in Pennsylvania, you are allowed to drive with 2 broken arms as long as you're not on narcotics. So the surgeon actually told me, "You could have been driving the whole time." And I'm like, "Wow, why didn't you tell me?" No, I didn't want to do that. But anyways, who would have thought? So I'm much more leery on the roads these days. Today, we are going to finish up the book of Genesis. Who would have ever thought we got here, right? You thought Genesis goes on and on forever. Today, we're going to look at two things. We're going to look at the blessing of a father and the forgiveness of a brother, or the reassurance of a brother. Those are the two things that we're going to look at today. And before we jump into it, I want to have Corey put on the first family tree of. So if you remember, we're going to talk about all these people today. So I want you to memorize them. Of course, I don't. But we're going to talk. So remember Leah. Here's all of Leah's children over here: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and I can't say it. There you go. Thank you. And then Dinah, and then Rachel, who had Joseph and Benjamin. And then Bilhah, who had Daniel and Naphtali, and Zilpha, who had Gad and Asher. So we're going to look at all of them because Jacob is now ready to die, and he is going to bless each of his boys. Now, I want to point this out as well. I do believe that God has instilled in each of us to want our parents' blessings. I'm also going to tell you that some of the blessings that these boys got would not be blessings that I would want to get. And we're going to look a little bit about that as we go through this, but I'll also talk about a parent's blessing in the end as well. So let's jump into it, and we're going to look at verse 1 of chapter 49. Then Jacob called his sons and said to them, "Gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come. Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. So Jacob is saying here, listen, come together, boys. I'm going to tell you. Now, the interesting thing about these blessings, it's not just a blessing in may you be blessed and may you do well, but it's also a prophecy. This is the first time in the Bible that we get to see a human. Jesus has made, or God has made prophecies in the future, or in before in Genesis, but this is the first time in the Bible that a human makes prophecies about other people. Again, guided by the Holy Spirit. But this is Jacob making prophecies about his sons and blessing them in the process. And so Jacob does some interesting stuff here in the way he blesses them. He just doesn't go down in birth order and bless them one after another. He jumps around a bit, but he starts out with Leah's boys. So that's where we're going to jump next. He starts off with Reuben. Again, if you remember, Reuben sounds like he has seen my misery, because Leah said, God has looked upon me and has seen my misery because he knows that my husband loves my sister, who is also his wife, my sister more than me. So Reuben sounds like, in Hebrew, he sees my misery. And here's what Jacob says about Reuben. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my mighty, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power, turbulent as the waters, you will no longer excel. For you went to your father's bed, onto my couch, and defiled it. So Jacob gives his blessing to Reuben, which, I don't think it sounds much like a blessing. He says to Reuben, listen, Reuben, you were born in a state of power. You were born in a position of power. You were born to be a leader. You were my firstborn. You were the first sign of my strength. But Reuben, you're as turbulent as the waters. So what I imagine here is he's saying to Reuben, you vacillate wild. You're churning. You're unpredictable. You're like one of those rapids that you go on whitewater rafting. You're unpredictable. You're dangerous. You're impulsive. You can't be trusted. You can't control your passions. You're a dangerous, impulsive being. And then what does he point out as an example of that? This we looked at in Genesis 35. The example of that is when he had sex with one of his father's wives and the mother of two of his brothers, Dan and Naphtali. And so here's the interesting thing about Reuben. When Reuben gets to the land of Canaan and they become a tribe, there is no leader that ever emerges from the tribe of Reuben. There's no judge, there's no king, there's no prophet. Not one of them ever came from the land or from the tribe of Reuben. Interestingly enough, they also, if you can switch that, by the way, Corey, I'm going to have you scurry around like a mouse today. If you could go to the map of the tribes. So if you look here, Reuben, the tribe of Reuben, when they get to the promised land 400 years later, they ask for their inheritance not where God wanted them to be, but on the wrong side of the river. So Reuben's tribe is down here. They were the first tribe to be caught by the Assyrians and taken off into captivity. So what we get to see is that God's prophecy through Jacob comes through in that Reuben, even though he was the firstborn, becomes the least or the last. We could also call that Simon over here too. But Reuben goes from being first to last. And they're the first to be captured and the first to be taken off. And so what Jacob prophesies about his son Reuben comes true. And I do feel for Reuben. Again, remember, the firstborn had three rights, a double portion, which goes to Joseph, the priestly responsibilities, that is to carry the spiritual leadership within the church, and then kind of the political leadership within the family, and then kind of the what I will call the political leader. And we're going to see that Reuben, those rights all get stripped away from him. Again, I want to point out one other thing. We talked about it last time, because Joseph was really blessed in chapter 48. Look at Manasseh right up there and Ephraim. Ephraim was the one got blessed. He was the youngest who got to be the firstborn, even though his tribe is tiny and Manasseh is the biggest one. Ephraim is the one that becomes the most important. You also see that half of Manasseh and Gad join Reuben in claiming territory on the wrong side of the river. So again, remember during the age when Israel was a country, Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh are on the wrong side where God told them that's not the promised land. Okay, now, next we get to two brothers. And the next two brothers that Jacob blesses are Simeon and Levi. Simeon are two. They're the two sons of Leah again. Simeon is sounds like, or it says, the one who hears me. That is, Leah said, God hears me. And then Levi means to be attached. And she said, Jacob will now attach or connect with me or love me, because now I've now had him three sons. I'm thinking, when I'm trying to imagine these 12 brothers standing around the bed and they hear Reuben's, and they're thinking, oh my, that's not much of a blessing. I'm thinking Simeon and Levi are like thinking through their heads, what is Dad going to say to us? If you remember, Levi and Simeon, we talked about this in Genesis 34, they're the ones that when Jacob did nothing, when their sister Dinah, who was also Leah's daughter, Dinah gets raped, Jacob does nothing, and Simeon and Levi do what? They come up with that dastardly little plan to have everybody be castrated, be circumcised, close but not quite, circumcised, same area, but circumcised, and when they're in the midst of their pain, he does what? He comes and he kills them all, and then they hamstring the oxen and the cattle, right? So listen to their... Jacob lumps both of them together. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence. Let me not enter into their council. Let me not join their assembly. For they have killed men in their anger and hamstrung oxen as they please. Cursed be their anger so fierce and their fury so cruel. I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. God here, as we talked about before when we looked at this story, God says through Jacob, listen, because you took justice into your own hands, because you acted in a self-righteous anger, I will disperse you among your people. Now, this is a hard passage, because God really comes down on these two brothers for what they did to Shechem and the Shechemites. Again, I think Jacob was passive, and again, God is clear. He does not like us to take justice into our own hands. He does not like us to take revenge into our own hands. But where in the world does justice come from? There's a right way of justice, and there's a wrong way of justice. And what God is saying here is these two brothers used their anger in a way that they shouldn't have done. And then he says, as a result of this, I am going to disperse you among your brothers. The tribe of Simeon is really interesting. At the beginning of the march across the wilderness in the 40 years, when they took the census, if you ever read Numbers, which I applaud you if you do, but in the first census in Numbers 1, what we find is that Simeon was the third largest tribe in that census when they looked at the men. When you look at the tribe 35 years later in the second census of Numbers, in Numbers 26, they had lost what? 63% of their tribe. When they marched for 40 years, Simeon greatly diminished in the number of people. They lost, I think, more people in the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness than any other tribe. When they get to the Promised Land, and again, we can have you jump there, Corey, if you get to the Promised Land, where does their land get? Right here, in the middle of Judah. What happens as Simeon goes through, as Israel continues to be a country? Guess what happens? Simeon, eventually, the people of Simeon get dispersed across Judah, and they disappear as a distinctive tribe. And this entire place becomes the land of Judah, and Simeon disappears. God's prediction of what would happen to Judah comes true, and they get dispersed among the people, in this case, Judah. Now, if you look up here, you'll also notice that Levi doesn't have a tribe up there. Right? We talked about this as well. What happened to the Levites? They also get scattered among the people, but in a more broader way. Why? Because they became the priesthood. The firstborn, the element of the firstborn that becomes the priestly or the spiritual leaders of their brothers gets taken to Levi. Now, here's the fascinating part. And again, I don't get this, and it troubles me, I'll be honest. But Levi gets restored. Why does Levi get restored? Why do they get to become the priest? You'll find the answer in Exodus 32. In Exodus 32, the children of Israel are worshiping the golden calf. Moses comes down and he says, listen, you need to take up swords and to attack those that have worshipped the golden calf. Who was the tribe that rallied with Moses and did what he asked them to do? The tribe of Levi. They took up the sword and they killed 3,000 fellow Israelites for worshiping the golden calf. I'm like, okay, God, they got in trouble because they killed these men, and then they get restored because they killed more men. Huh. But again, it's the difference between, and again, do I make complete sense of this? No, because I'm not God. But God says what? My way, you know, leave wrath to me. What's the verse say? That God's wrath is just, our wrath is often unjust. But boy, is that hard, at least for me, to put together that the Levites get restored to the priesthood because they killed 3,000 of their fellow Israelites for worshiping a false idol. Then the Levites get their cities among the people, and they take their priesthood. They become the cities of refuge where if you murder somebody accidentally or kill somebody accidentally, you can go to that city of refuge. You can stay there until the high priest dies and all those things that we're not going to talk about today. But again, it seems like what God is saying here is there's a difference between my wrath and your wrath. My wrath is just because I know all and I know what you don't know. And you take things and make them self-centered. Next comes Judah, whose name means praise. I will praise the Lord, Leah said when he was born. By the way, I'm thinking, Judah. Here's Judah. He's thinking, well, I had a Canaanite wife. I sold my brother into slavery. I had sex with my daughter-in-law. I had a baby with her. Wow, I'm in trouble. Look what happened to my three older brothers. But things turn out differently for him. Again, remember, like Levi, Judah was restored because of his time, being an advocate for Benjamin. But listen to his prophecy and his blessing. Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hands will be on the necks of your enemies. Your father's sons will bow down to you. You are a lion cub, Judah. You return to your prey, my son. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness who dares to rouse him? The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor will the ruler's staff from between his feet, until he whom it belongs. By the way, that phrase is so hard to translate. People don't really know what that translation. This is the NIV's attempt to translate it. Until he to whom it belongs shall come, and the obedience of nations shall be his. He will tether his donkey to a vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. So what we see here is the firstborn's responsibilities get divided between Levi and Judah, all Leah's children, right? All Leah's sons. So Levi gets the priestly or the spiritual responsibilities of the firstborn, and Judah gets the political or the family leader. The one who is the executor of the will and all those things goes to Judah. And what does he say about Judah? Judah, your brothers will praise you. Your hands will be on the necks of your enemies. Your father's sons, your other brothers, will bow down to you. You are a, this is where we get what? Jesus is in Revelation 5:5. The Lion of Judah comes from right here. When Jesus is the Lion of Judah, that's because God, through Jacob, declares him to be like the cub of a lion. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares rouse him? And then he says what? Judah's family will always have the leader in its family. Now, the NIV, what it basically is trying to say here, and we, again, this appears to be a decent translation of the Hebrew, but it's hard to know what it says, until he whom it belongs shall come. Most people believe that reference is to Jesus. It's just hard to figure out exactly what's going on there. But that's the one who is the true leader, who again comes from the tribe of Judah. And then it says something really interesting. Eventually, Judah will tether his donkey to a vine and his colt to the choicest branch. Ladies and gentlemen, who in their right mind would take their donkey or their colt and say, oh, here's a grapevine, let me tie my donkey or my goat to a grapevine? Especially when it's your best one. Because what would a donkey or a colt do to that? They'd rip right through that vine. They'd tear up your little choice vines and they'd go on their way. What this is saying is there's going to come a day when there are so many grapes and there is so much, look at this, there is so much wine that you're going to wash your clothes in wine. This is a land full of what? Milk and honey. There's going to be so much wine that you're not going to even care if your donkey walks off with your best vine because you have so many vines. You're going to have so much wine that you're going to wash your clothes in it. In fact, you're going to drink so much wine that your eyes are going to be stained with wine. And you're going to drink so much milk because, again, back in the day, they didn't drink milk. They just couldn't go to the grocery store and buy milk like we could. Milk was a luxury. You're going to drink so much milk that your teeth are going to be stained white from the milk. It's going to be it's going to be amazing. Now, what was he prophesying here? Was he talking about the promised land or was he talking about heaven? Probably both. But Judah was going to be the person who brings him in to all of this abundance. For us, Jesus is going to bring us into all this abundance, where we're going to have so much that we don't care what our donkeys and colts destroy, and we're going to have more than we ever care to know what to do with. Again, when it was a land full of flowing with milk and honey, we don't appreciate it because we have all the honey and milk we want, generally. That and those times, those were great luxuries that people rarely got. Okay, so that's Judah. Zebulun comes next, and for some reason Jacob skips orders. He goes to the last of Leah's children. He was born a little bit later, and why he skips Issachar, I don't know. But he goes to Zebulun next, which means honor. My husband will now honor me because I've had a son for him. Again, she keeps going back, hoping that this is the case. Zebulun will live by the seashore and will have a haven and will become a haven for ships, and his border will extend towards Sidon. Now, if we go back to the map, this is an interesting one, you all. Zebulun is that little purple up there. Are they on the sea? No, they're not on the sea. Neither one. They're on a mountain range. They're on a high point of the land, and from there you can see the Mediterranean Sea and the Sea of Galilee. And so what some people say is that a better interpretation, which says becomes a haven for ships, says that you will be able to look towards the sea. We don't know much about this tribe. This tribe is one of the quieter tribes that we don't know about. And we don't have, there's no record that they ever had anything to do with shipping or seafaring and all of that stuff. We do know that they supplied the most soldiers of all the tribe to David's army, which is kind of interesting when you look at how tiny it is. We're going to find out when we get to Naphtali that Jesus spent most of his time on the earth in those two tribes. And that's going to come out in a prophecy later on. Okay, now, if we go back to the next brother who's going to be blessed, some of these are going to go faster now because they don't have much said about them. We're going to go back to Leah's second to last son, Issachar, which means reward. Leah said, I am rewarded for having a husband like Jacob. Mighty, all forever forgiving Leah says, I am rewarded to have a husband like Jacob. Issachar is a raw-boned donkey. Also means strong donkey. Issachar is a strong donkey. By the way, I don't know how many of you would find it a blessing if your father said to you, hey, you're like a strong donkey. I guess that can be viewed as a blessing. It depends on who you are. But and then it says, Issachar is a raw-boned or strong donkey lying down among the sheep pens. What kind of donkey goes to the sheep pens? When he sees how good in his resting place and how pleasant in his land, he will bend his shoulder to the burden and submit to forced labor. Well, here's where it's interesting what Jacob says about his son Issachar. He's saying, Issachar, you're really strong. But Issachar, you like to lay around and do not much of anything. What you really find most comfortable is laying around with a sheep, not working like you can. But then he says, what's going to happen is you're going to bend your shoulder to the burden and submit to forced labor like a good donkey. Now, if we go back to that map, sorry, Corey, it's Speaking of donkeys, I'm using you like a rented mule today. But if you go back here to Issachar, Issachar is right by his other brother, Zebulun. And what happened? Because of where it was positioned, Issachar was often raided by foreign countries. Of all the tribes, this is the one tribe that experienced as much slavery and as much servanthood as any of the other tribes. So if we go back to the prophecy, what is he going to say? You're going to bend your shoulder to the burden and you're going to submit to forced labor. They were raided by other countries and they had to submit themselves to the tyranny of countries coming in. And again, you can see where that is. Okay, now, then we get to Dan. Now, so what Jacob does now is he switches to Rachel's servant Bilhah's son, his first son, and then he messes things up even more. But he goes back to his Bilhah's first son, Dan. Rachel named Dan because she said, "I have been in a long struggle with my sisters and not my sister, and now the Lord has vindicated me in that battle." Dan will provide justice for his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan, again, not a very great blessing. Dan will be a snake by the roadside. Huh. A viper along the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider tumbles backwards. I look to your deliverance, Lord. So Jacob says to Dan, you're going to provide justice for the people. By the way, who's the most famous Danite that we know? Samson. The judge Samson came from the tribe of Dan. He was the one judge that came from Dan. Samson was an interesting judge. He had his own issues. He had his own troubles and struggles, right? But what is Dan most famous for? How did they become a viper and snake who bites its rider by the heel? Jeroboam, one of the first kings of Israel, set up a golden calf idol, and one of them became in Dan. And later, Dan becomes what? The center of idol worship in Israel. One of the things you should always think about when you hear people talk about the tribe of Dan, they were where the most idols were. That's where the high points originated. That's where all of those things happened. So if we look again at Dan, where is Dan on the map? It's right down here. It's not that big of a territory, but look how close it is to Jerusalem. And again, eventually Benjamin and Judah are going to team up, and they're going to become the southern tribes, and the rest of the tribes are going to become Israel, and this is going to become Judah. And again, Simeon's kind of incorporated that, but Benjamin and Judah are the two tribes that stay with David and stay loyal to him. And again, if you see, Benjamin has Jerusalem right up here, and Dan becomes a source of worship where people go when they lose Jerusalem. So Dan becomes this kind of thorn in their side or a viper that bites the rest of the people. Okay, now Jacob jumps and he goes to back to he now jumps to Leah's servant Zilpha, and he talks about his two sons. The first one is Gad. Leah named him Gad, which means good fortune or troop or army. Good fortune or troop or army, because she said, "I have good fortune. I have another son." Again, not in today's language. It's like a woman had a son for you. I guess a surrogate. I don't know. It kind of is for surrogates. But she said, "I have good fortune of having another son, or now I have a troop of boys." What does Jacob say about him? Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, and he will attack their heel. If you look again at our map, thank you for jumping back there, Corey. Gad is way over here. It's over here with Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh, which again means what? They're way on the edge. Like Issachar, they get raided frequently, and they have to fight off raiders all the time. They win some of those battles. They lose a lot of those battles throughout the years. Gad also supplied many troops to King David's army. Now, we get to Asher, Zilpha's second son, which means happy, because Rachel said what? Or Leah said, "Women will now call me happy." Again, remember Leah and her long struggle. She says, "Now other women will call me happy because I've had a son." Again, Asher's food will be rich. He will provide delicacies fit for a king. Now, if we look where Asher is, right along the Mediterranean Sea. What is the tribe of Asher famous for? Fertile and productive farmland. It had some of the most choice farmland in the country of Israel. It was a land of abundance when it comes to the type of crops that they produce. Again, providing delicacies fit for the king. We don't get much about Asher either, but when Deborah was a judge of Israel, and she got back from a war that she led, she produced a song, her victory song. And guess what she said about Asher? Here's what she says about Asher. Asher did not come to help me in my war, but Asher stayed in its coves and remained along the coast. It appears that Asher's abundance and riches caused it to grow lazy and content and not willing to join its brothers in their battles. Finally, Jacob goes back to Bilhah's second son, Naphtali, which means my struggle. Rachel says, I was in a struggle with my sister for years, and now I have won, which I wouldn't say that she won, but she thought she won. And it says something here. Naphtali is a dawn to set free that bears beautiful fawns. Probably a better way to translate that is Naphtali is a doe set free who uses beautiful words. Which again, many believe is a reference to Jesus, because again, if we look in Matthew 4, and we get a prophecy used in that, Matthew 4, which goes back to when we looked at this in Advent, we looked at this passage. But here's what it says in Matthew 4. When Jesus heard that John was put into prison, he withdrew to Galilee, leaving Nazareth, and he went to live in Capernaum, which was by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, to fulfill what had been said through the prophet Isaiah. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali have the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, the Galilee of the Gentiles. The people living in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of shadow of death, a light has dawned. Jesus, go back to that again. Jesus, as I said earlier, spent most of his time in those two tribes. Because that's where Jesus spent much of his early ministry. Capernaum is in there, and some of the other cities that Jesus spent a great deal of time. And that may be the beautiful words of Naphtali. Now, we're finally down to Joseph. And again, remember, Joseph really got his blessing in chapter 48 when Jacob blessed his two boys. But here's what he says about Joseph, which is Rachel's firstborn, Jacob's true love. The boy of many, a coat of many colors. Joseph means, may the Lord add another son to me. What does he say about Joseph? Of course, you can guess that Joseph and Judah get the two biggest ones. Here's a long one for Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful vine near a spring, whose branches climb over a wall. So Jacob starts out and says, Joseph, you are amazingly fruitful, faithful. You are faithful because you're close to a spring. That is, you are connected to God who has made you faithful, so faithful that you climbed over the wall of the vineyard to the outside. With bitterness, archers, his brothers, attacked him. They shot at him with hostility, but his bow remained steady. His strong arm stayed limber because the hand of the Almighty One of Jacob, because of the shepherd, the rock of Israel, because of your Lord, your father's God who helped you, because of the Almighty who blesses you with the blessings of the sky above, blessings of the deep spring below, blessings of the breast and the womb. Your father's blessings are greater than the blessings of the ancient mountains, than the bounty of the age-old hills. Let all these rest on the head of Joseph and on the brow of the prince among his brothers. By the way, if you want any blessing, you get the blessing of Joseph, because you get it all. Couple things I want to point out. He says, Joseph, you are a fruitful vine because you stay connected to the Lord. He ties that back together, and we're going to get down there. And then he said, your brothers did what? They tried to take you down, but they couldn't do it. Your bow remained steady, and your arms remained limber and strong. And then he gives God five titles. The Mighty One of Jacob. This is one of the first times, I think it is the first time, that Jacob actually refers to God as the God of Jacob. What did he used to do as we go through the book of Genesis? He also often referred to God as what? The God of Abraham and Isaac. He never included himself. Now that he gets to the end, he says to Joseph, hey, God, the mighty one of Jacob. And then he says what? Remember Jacob last week we talked about it? Refers to God as his shepherd, the mighty one of God, the shepherd, the rock of Israel, your father Jacob's God, the Almighty. Jacob goes through and he gives five titles for God in close succession, and he said, Joseph, this is who blesses you. This is who blessed me. And then he goes on to say what? I have been blessed more than the ancient mountains. I have more bounty than the age-old hills. At the end of his life, Jacob is finally able to say, God, you blessed me in a way beyond what I deserved. We see Jacob here on his deathbed saying, God, I am your follower. All that battling that Jacob did, all that struggle that Jacob did comes together here, and we see him say, Joseph, may you follow God the way I did, and may God bless you the way God blessed me. What a complete circle for Jacob. Finally, we get to Benjamin. Again, Rachel's youngest, the one who caused Rachel's death because she died during childbirth. Benjamin is not the name that Rachel gave Benjamin. Benjamin was named by Jacob, which means the son of my right hand. Jacob rejected Rachel's name for Benjamin and gave him the name Benjamin. He then says to Benjamin, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning, he devours his prey. In the evening, he divides his plunder. Benjamin becomes quite a tribe. If you want, I don't want to go into it because it's not fun to read, but if you want to see, I would say that Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, was a tribe of warriors, and they were not nice people. If you want to read about some of their dastardly deeds in the afternoon, if you want some fun reading, read Judges 19 and 20. Some of the things that the tribe of Benjamin did were not nice. But here's what Jacob says to him. You're going to become a ravenous wolf who can't be satisfied, who devours the people around you. And that's kind of what Benjamin did. Now, again, they stayed loyal to David's family, and this is where the city of Jerusalem was at. Verse 28, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them when he blessed them and giving each a blessing appropriate to him. It ends here by saying that Jacob blessed each of his boys in ways that were appropriate to them. It goes back to one of my favorite passages where it says, train up in a child in the way that he should go, which again means in the way that he is bent. The Hebrew means like a tree that is bent in a certain direction. You don't take that tree and force it to go in a different way unless you really are bound to do that. But what it really suggests is, hey, know your child really well and then shape them that's fitting to who they are, who their character is, who their personality is, because each of your children needs a different kind of blessing. Each of your children needs a different kind of guidance based on their bent, based on who they are. It takes wisdom, it takes courage to parent that way, but that's what we each need from our parent. That is, we need each of our parents to bless us, to see us for who we are, and to grant us the freedom to become who we're designed to be. Sometimes, as we all know, that's hard to do, especially when your children are bent in different ways that you're bent. Sometimes that becomes hard to let them go in that way. But when we don't get our parents' blessing, there seems to be this hole that develops that becomes difficult to overcome. It can be overcome, but it leaves a void. Some people struggled with that for a long time. Then it goes on. In verse 29, and it says, Jacob gave them these instructions. I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave of the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave in the field of somebody who is someplace in Canaan, which Abraham bought from the field as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite. And Abraham and his wife Sarah were buried there. Isaac and Rebekah were buried there. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave were bought from the Hittites, if I can speak. When Jacob finished giving this instructions to his son, he drew his feet up into the bed, he breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Jacob dies at this point. He gives his boys the instructions, gather me and bury me in the cave that was bought from Ephraim the Hittite. Listen, at this point, Jacob, because of his connection to Joseph, could have been buried like the Pharaoh in Egypt. He picks instead to be buried in some random cave bought from the Hittites in Canaan. Why? Because Egypt was not his home. His home was in the promised land in Canaan. That's where he wanted to spend eternity. He didn't want to spend eternity in the land that was not his home. He was a pilgrim passing through. So he says to his sons, take me back to Canaan. I want to be gathered. I want to spend eternity with my people. I find it ironic, and I said this last week, who's buried there? Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and Jacob and Leah. Not Rachel, his love. It's both fitting and sad for me that that happened. Leah, he spends eternity with her, the woman that he did not love as much as Rachel. Rachel's buried where? On some road close to Bethlehem. So, he draws his feet up in bed and dies. 50, Joseph throws himself on his father and weeps over him and kisses him. Joseph takes his father's death and responds in a very emotional way. Then Joseph directed the physicians of Egypt in his service to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days. Embalming was something else. Embalming him for the time that was required for embalming. And the Egyptians mourned for him for 70 days. The official royal mourning period for royals in Egypt was 72 days. Joseph came pretty close to the official mourning period for royals. He got 70 days out of 72. That's a long mourning period. Long mourning period. When the days of mourning had passed, after 70 days, Joseph, look here. Joseph doesn't go directly to Pharaoh. He knows Pharaoh really well. Joseph says to Pharaoh's court, so he goes to somebody that works for Pharaoh like him, and he says to them, if I have found favor in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me and tell him, my father made me swear an oath and said, I am about to die. Bury me in the tomb I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Now let me go and bury my father there. Then I will return. So he has somebody who's in Pharaoh's court with him go to Pharaoh and say, hey, Joseph's father, Jacob, asked him to go back to the land of Canaan and bury his father there. Could Joseph have permission to do that? Tells you again, even though Joseph is amazingly powerful in Egypt, he still has to get permission from Pharaoh to do this. Pharaoh in verse 6 says, go up and bury your father as he made you swear to do. By the way, Martin Luther says, this next thing that we're going to read is the most celebrated funeral in the history of the Bible. And listen to what happens. So Joseph went up to bury his father. All of Pharaoh's officials accompanied him, the dignitaries of his court and all the dignitaries of Egypt, besides all the members of Joseph's household, his brothers and their belongings, and those belonging to their father's household, only their children and their flocks and herds were left in Goshen. Chariots and horsemen also went up with him. It was a very large company. They covered hundreds of miles, this big group of Egyptians, and Jacob's boys and some of their family. Can you imagine the scene that must have made for that big caravan going across those territories back to Canaan? Massive funeral procession. It's large. I often wondered, what in the world did the people, when they saw this big group of Egyptians coming, all these chariots and all these horses and all these other people, did they think were being invaded by the Egyptians? Right? So Jacob's sons, then when they reached the threshing floors of Atad near Jordan, they lamented loudly and bitterly, and Joseph observed a 7-day period of mourning for his father. They had 7 more days of lamenting and mourning. When the Canaanites, you thought some funerals were long. That's a long funeral. When the Canaanites who lived there saw the mourning of the threshing floors of Attid, they said, the Egyptians are holding a ceremony, a solemn ceremony of mourning. This is why the place near the Jordan is called what? The mourning of the Egyptians. I can't imagine what the people of Canaan must have thought when they thought all these Egyptians there mourning wildly before this cave. It had to confuse them mightily. So Jacob's sons did as he had commanded. They carried him to the land of Canaan, buried him in the cave where Abraham had bought along with the field as a burial place from Ephraim the Hittite. And after burying their father, Joseph returned to Egypt together with his brothers and all those who had gone with him to bury his father. Okay. The last little thing that we're going to get in the book of Genesis. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, what if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrong we did to him? So they sent word to Joseph. So they said, you know what? What if? I'm trying to think. They lived with Joseph for 17 years now. But they're thinking, maybe Joseph has fooled us. Maybe the only reason he hasn't killed us or enslaved us or does anything wrong with us is because our father's been alive. Now that our father's dead, maybe he's finally going to get revenge on him. So they sent a messenger to Joseph to say something to them. Here's the question I want you to think about this afternoon. Did Jacob really tell this to them, or did they make it up so that they could hope that Joseph wouldn't kill them? I don't know. I think they made it up, but I don't know that. What happens here? They send somebody to Joseph who says, I've asked you, your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you're to say to Joseph. I ask you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of your servants of God, of your father. When this message came to him, Joseph wept. Why do I think Joseph wept? He couldn't believe that his brothers, after 17 years, didn't know that he had not forgiven them. He was shocked that they would still think that he had bitterness in his heart and that he was still holding a grudge. I'm sure he thought, how could my brothers miss my heart after 17 years? But isn't that true in our relationships with people sometimes? Sometimes when we're with people, we don't know that they have truly forgiven us. And again, sometimes that pays off because you don't want to think that somebody's forgiven you when they haven't, right? Joseph is weeping. Then his brothers, after the messenger left, the brothers came and they did what? They threw themselves down before him and they said, "We are your slaves." One more time, fulfilling the dream that Joseph had when he was 17 years old that said, my brothers will bow down before me. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid. Am I God? I love this next line. You intended to harm me. He does not cover up his brother's sins. He does not say, oh, that was no big deal. Nope. He says, you all did this. This was bad. This was bad. One of the things I think we sometimes struggle with as Christians is we downplay the harm that was done to us. Joseph doesn't do that. He says, you all intended this to harm me. But I'm not God. But God, what? God is greater than your plans. You intended this to harm me, but God intended it for good. Why? To accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. You intended to harm me. You wanted to kill me. You were jealous of me, and that hurt me deeply. But guess what? I'm not God, and God took what you meant for evil and made it into good. Sometimes when we're really struggling to forgive those around us, we need to remember we don't get to see the big picture. But you all, don't downplay the hurt that was done to you. Life is a series of balancing acts between what was intended by others and what God intended. God can often take what others mean for evil and do for evil to his own good. Do we completely understand it? I don't. Because I get lost because I'm limited. I'm not God. I can't see what God sees. But what a word from Joseph. Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the savings of many lives. By the way, many years later, Jesus could say the same thing about his brothers and sisters, Jewish friends, right? So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children. And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. What a reassurance from their brother. That they get reassured again. Hey, you're okay. We're good. We're in this together. I'll finish up quickly. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with his father's families. He lived 110 years. He was a youngster when he died. And they saw the third generations of Ephraim's children, and also the children of somebody, the son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die. I can't imagine who was left. He's almost the youngest. But God will surely come to your aid. God will surely come to your aid and take you out of this land. He promised in an oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath. God will be surely come to your aid, and you must carry my bones back from this place. So Joseph died at the age of 110, they embalmed him and placed him in a coffin in Egypt. Now, so Joseph dies at 110. They place him in a coffin. Now, according to the book of Hebrews, Joseph was never buried in Egypt. Where did they set the coffin of Joseph? That coffin sat there almost 400 years. As a silent reminder to what? Someday, we're going to the promised land. Someday, Joseph says, we're going back. Someday, Joseph says what? God will surely come to your aid, and you must carry my bones back to this place. That day happened 370-some years from this, actually a little bit less than that. And in Exodus 13, verse 19, it says this, Moses took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath. He said to them, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones back with you from this place. Joseph dies at the end of the book of Genesis, not ever seeing the fulfillment of redemption that God had promised him. You look at Hebrews in the faith passage, so many people died with not seeing the fulfillment of God's state of redemption. We often live in that state. We live in the in-between when God is moving and God is working and what God will finally do. The lesson I take from today is, how do we bless our children in the way that is intended for each of them? And how do we accept and give forgiveness even when the hurts are mighty, even when the hurts are strong? And how do we continue to hold on to the hope that we will someday get to the promised land? That is, we'll get to heaven. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for this example of blessings and even some discipline that we see here. But Father, thank you for the blessing that Jacob did for his sons. Thank you for the restoration and the faith and the faithfulness that you continued to represent to Jacob, despite who he was. Father, we just ask that we continue to hold on to the hope that you present to us, that someday we will be in the land of abundance where there is so much wine and so much milk that our eyes are colored with the stain of wine and our teeth whiter than milk. Thank you so much for that coming promise and the way that you will restore and redeem the world, the creation that groans, waiting for that restoration to happen. Father, help us as we sometimes groan in that as well. In your name, amen.